Black Rifle Coffee, baby. Freedom fuel.
Spring collection. If you're looking for some new gear,
check out the Black Rifle Coffee Spring Collection.
This Spring Collection is now live on BlackRifleCoffee.com.
Hey, kids.
We are actually doing our next large collaboration with JCPenney. We're going to be releasing summer overall shorts in addition to our spring collection from Black Rifle Coffee. So stay tuned greatness that's going to be coming your way, man. And next thing you know, we're going to be going live with the fall collection. Your autumn greatness is going to be coming. Yeah. You're going to love
We're going to do a whole curtain line.
You know, yeah.
I could just say, like, we'll collab. Actually, that would be fucking pretty sweet if you think about who's that really famous Martha Stewart. I would do a collab with her. Yeah. She's pretty cool. She did a collab with like Snoop Dogg.
She managed going to prison pretty well.
Did you ever see her mugshot?
Yeah.
She's just smiling at it.
Yeah. She's like,
hey, going to jail.
I bet she had like a full kitchenette. Oh, she was in prison, and
I don't know.
I bet she just had a great time.
I bet. She's got to be pushing like 90. No, 80. I don't know.
She is up there a little bit, but
she's up there.
She's still doing it. Like, she just released a new line of something. I can't remember exactly what it was. Like, wow, Mark still working. It's amazing what you can come back from these days, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing what you can come back from. Hey, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know? Are we ready? What are we doing?
Are we rolling? Mm. How is the audio on these? Are we good? Are we all set?
Check audio. Okay. Good. I guess I need like what I brought these glasses so I could actually have a permanent set of glasses here. So I didn't want to forget them. But that's like the least of our conversation points that we need to talk about. When we first met, I was thinking about this the other day. Mm. You were at the University of Minnesota, right?
I had just finished up my degree at Michigan State.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. Minnesota. yeah, when we met up in Montana,
Whitefish, Montana.
Yeah. Yeah, I was working for Funker 530, which is still going today. So I still chat with one of the other guys is working for Hardhead Veterans.
Josh
is over there, and I was talking to him the other day, and it's cool to see everybody still like you know they pick up new stuff that they're working on, and the Hardheaded Veterans is a veteran owned and operated company that's doing Kevlar helmets and bump helmets and stuff like that, and. I was chatting with him and it's bringing up all those old memories. But it was funny when I was in Afghanistan, like towards the end of it, I started like brainstorm. You know how you get when you go through these kind of highs and lows of being in combat and then dealing with extreme boredom. Mm. Your brain acts a very different way to like you have a lot to process, but you also like kind of can come up with some unique things and you can be creative actually in these moments of extreme boredom. And for whatever reason, while I was in Afghanistan, I like got this idea and I started like writing it in my Write for Rain notebook, and I called it Grunt Tube. And I was like, I wanted to kind of encapsulate, even then while I was still in Afghanistan, I was like, we're at the precipice of combining personal cameras and the capabilities for Marines and soldiers to carry those things into warfare. Like when I was in Afghanistan, this was 2010, 2011, we were GoPro 2-3.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there. We're at like, you know, the first prototype had come out and then they had fixed some bugs. And like, we were at that second onset of GoPros. And like, it was the first time guys were like really wearing GoPros into combat, and I was like, this is really interesting. And I had brainstormed this website platform that was essentially like, hey, it was an archive of people to be able to upload content too, so that we could hopefully learn from what was happening downrange and be able to develop better SOPs and stuff like that, as the way that we were operating in Afghanistan really wasn't anything doctrinally that we had really worked on leading up to that from a traditional scout sniper standpoint.
Seriously?
Like,
you hadn't done like some of the things that you're doing in Afghanistan before?
We just because of some of the ROEs, like we weren't able to go out in small man teams, which is the bread and butter of the scout sniper profession, right? You go out preferably, like, I think four man is kind of like the best way that we can operate, given the parameters and the way that we had trained given up to that point. Like, you get good rotations on security, you're a small element. That was really the way to go. And it came through. I don't even think that from the very beginning we were able to leave the wire with that few of people. I remember in December, which would have been a couple months in, like, they came out with the mandate, like, you can't leave with less than 12 people.
Right.
So we had to kind of shift how we were thinking about how we were going out and how we were implementing scout snipers. And what we kind of settled on was actually very similar to tactics that they were doing in Vietnam, to where, you know, I'm sure you read books where it was like, sniper up, spotter up, right? Like, you're just kind of camouflaging down to fit in with the normal infantry patrols, to be able to still provide support for what they were doing, because kind of the typical, like, go get in a hide site just wasn't, you couldn't do that because of not being able to leave the wire with so few of people. But also there wasn't any elevated positions with where we were in. Like, we were in flat farmland, and the highest building was two stories.
Right.
So every way that we typically would operate was just kind of out the window. And so I spent a majority of Afghanistan embedded with, you know, 0311s and typical infantry. Like, I was really just a infantry guy with a sniper rifle. Like, that's all I really was at that point, which we kind of developed certain things in addition to that, a lot of leave behinds to be able to successfully kind of trick the enemy in the way to giving them something that they weren't expecting, based on the fact that we had to typically always move in a ranger file because of the IED threat, and we didn't really split up. Like, we didn't split forces. So we started doing that, and that was really beneficial for us. We started having a lot of success doing leave behinds and doing that. But from the very beginning, I don't even know why I did it, because I wasn't always a camera guy. I didn't like really have that.
Did you start wearing a GoPro?
I had a point and shoot camera.
Oh, got it.
I was trying to, I just didn't really have a lot of money back then, you know, being an E4 in the Marine Corps, like, you're not making a ton of money. No. And we ended up buying a lot of gear as well, that we wanted to be lightweight and be able to operate it a little bit differently. Like, but I had a point and shoot camera. Like, a lot of us just had point and shoot cameras, the ones that had the lens that extended out and you could kind of have a little bit of zoom.
Just some bullshit that you bought it.
Like, a $50 Sony point and shoot.
Right, right.
And everybody kind of had those. And just due to the kinetic nature of that deployment, I was like, this is crazy. I was like, this is insane, the amount of stuff that all of a sudden these guys are able to capture through video. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but I just kind of took it upon myself to be the one that was kind of going around to everybody and grabbing footage and kind of storing it all on a hard drive. And I was, as I was kind of combining this, and, you know, after 7 months of this, I'm like, if people knew what I have on this hard drive, like, it's crazy to think about, you know. So much stuff that still hasn't seen the light of day, you know?
Yeah.
And my brain kind of funneled all of that into this thing I called GruntTube, and I like made the framework for the website while I was in Afghanistan. It's like the little thing I would put my brain work on when I wasn't swinging a kettlebell around or whatever. But it was funny because after I got out and I went to school and going to Michigan State, it was using the GI Bill. What it ended up being basically a multimedia degree that was called professional writing, but was essentially using the current capabilities of different elements of media, learning how to use those and incorporate story into those and then be able to put it out well through different types of platforms or mediums or whatever. And Facebook came out in 2004, 2005 is when it really started to become useful. I remember when I first started using Facebook, it was still only available for college students. That's how it started.
Right.
And then they started opening up to a larger swath of the populace. And then, you know, you kind of evolved through this. And I remember doing projects in school on a couple different social media platforms. Like I did a project on like how ISIS was using Twitter in order to recruit people in 2014, which they were actually doing a very good job of using some of the free tools that they had to be able to get way more propaganda out into the world. And so as I'm looking at some of the stuff, I was like, oh, this, I still think this GruntTube idea is really cool. And I'm learning all of this other stuff and I'm learning how to incorporate this into a public platform that people could potentially participate in. And then, you know, I get out into the real world and, do the documentary for the 25, and then, Funker 530 reaches out to me and I'm like, this is exactly what I was going to do.
Right.
It's already been done. And they did a really good job in that it had already developed quite a good, following to it through Facebook. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me. And so that was like my first gig was doing some blogging and, combat related, writings on Funker 530. And that's how I met Jared. Jared was the first one that I met. Was Scott from Funker 530 linked me up with Jared.
Yeah.
And then started chatting with him. And then
Jared is often the first person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting how that works.
He's kind of a social butterfly.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, and then we met in
Whitefish,
Montana, because we were going to see if we could put together the resources to do a documentary on Benghazi.
Yeah. In 13 hours, because that was. I was up there with Chris Pronto.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if Tegan, those guys were up there, or Mark Geist. I know Chris was up there and maybe Mark. I'm not sure. I can't remember. Do you remember if Mark was up there?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just Chris.
I think it was just Chris.
Yeah.
And it was two other guys that I'd worked at the agency with. And then Chris Pronto and I worked together at the agency for several years.
Yeah.
Like we first met in Afghanistan in 2008.
Yeah.
And so I'd known those guys for years. So when we all met in Whitefish, which would be super funny for us to pull up that footage of us doing the, is it right after we did hipster waterboarding?
Yeah.
And then hipster waterboarding was the first video that Matt and Jared let me do, and it might have been the last one. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's right. I showed up. You guys filmed that here in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
Went up to Whitefish, and then I met you the next night in Whitefish. And I remember seeing hipster waterboarding as I got off the plane and then was going to meet you guys for the first time. I was like, it was like I had a million views in a couple hours or something like that. I was like, oh, this is great. I couldn't have kind of stumbled into a better position based on, you know, what my background was within the Marine Corps and then just getting a degree working with Funker. And then like all of a sudden, like we're just kind of in the mix of it together. Right. As you start Black Rifle
right
Coffee,
there.
Right.
Yeah. It was right in the center.
Yeah.
Cause I think, yeah, Vargas was there. Matt, Jared, a bunch of guys were up there at the same time. And we filmed some stuff up there because then we did part two when we threw, I got thrown into the lake, which wasn't as good as part one. Part one was like the so good.
Well, the sequels rarely are. They're never as good as the original, good. You know. Yeah.
They're never as good. But then I convince you to not fly home and just get on the bus with us as we went back.
Yeah, not exactly. I miss my flight.
That's right. Yeah. You missed your flight. And then I was like, just jump on the
RV.
We had an RV that we had rented Jay had loaned us.
Yeah.
And then we'd all drove it. So it was like Marty Scoveland, Vincent Vargas, Matt, me, Jared, Judd. And we drove this RV up there from here. And it was like, I don't know how many hours, but it was a long trip.
It's like
it was a long trip back.
11 hours. Yeah. And we're all hungover coming back. And it's funny to see, like, think of all the stuff that came from that initial interaction, you know, outside of me, you know, eventually the beginnings of starting to become a part of Black Rifle Coffee. But the Michael Bay movie that he ended up doing based on Chris's book in 13 Hours in Benghazi.
That's right.
I, you know, Michael Bay has done a lot of work and he's got his own specific style to it. It's like always been like a very exorbitant over the top filming style with like, you know, his classic like lens flares and like there's all of these, you know, like analytical breakdowns on YouTube of like why Michael Bay's style is his style. And South Park has made fun of him for like being on cocaine while he's making his movies. Right. But I think he did a phenomenal job with 13 Hours in Benghazi. I was, you know, I think we're always skeptical kind of like seeing like, oh, the guy from Michael The Office Bay. is
two guys from The Office.
Two guys from The Office are the GRS guys in Michael Bay's movie, but you're like, oh God, this is just like, where is this going to go? And James Badge Dale.
I don't know who that is.
He was one of the other GRS guys. He was in The Pacific as well. He's one of the actors in Pacific, who's playing the character. The Marine's name is escaping me, but Helmet for My Pillow. Sledge. He was Sledge. But it's funny because it's, I think that a lot of the public didn't know about GRS.
Nobody knew about
it.
Like we were all like super buttoned up about it.
Yeah. And that was the first time that the public really was like, wait, what is this other thing that is existing? You know, we're like very aware of Navy SEALs and all this stuff. And then all of a sudden you're thrust into like, wait, like, so there's these contractors that are helping the CIA and all of these, you know, different capabilities. And, you know, I think when I first learned about you, like I was picking your brain about it pretty relentlessly. But what was your experience like within like specifically kind of that GRS vein and was that something that you like look back on your career? Like that was one of the better.
I don't talk about it. I don't talk. I mean, I tell people, right? Like obviously I've talked about it, but I don't talk about it because most everybody in the organization, we try to keep pretty tight.
Yeah.
Like inside. So you can tell people, I mean, I've been out for 10 years.
Quiet professionals.
Yeah. It's pretty tight lipped. So I don't talk about it a lot. People know that that's, you know, that's where I was for 9.5, almost 10 years. You know, the guys were great. Like I had a ton of really interesting experiences through the organization that I could have never had anywhere else. And I'll keep it pretty tight.
Yeah.
Like I just don't talk about it because I think it's not professionally acceptable to keep talking about it. People know that's where I worked. I'm not trying to be elusive. I think it's a really good organization full of people that are very patriotic. I think the paramilitary side of the organization needs to have a much more prominent voice.
Yeah.
Because the guys that are actually like, you know, they spend time in the mill and then they typically go over there and they're doing a lot of the hard work. But yeah, that's not to be too vague. It's a really good organization full of great people.
Well, yeah, I think it's actually pretty refreshing to hear that, right?
Yeah.
In the era of, oh, look at me and like all the cool guy stuff that I did, that there's still a vestige of quiet professionalism that exists and probably should exist. Probably.
Yeah. Like I'm on a text string with a bunch of guys from the office that are still like, you know, doing stuff. And part of the thing is like, they know I just don't talk about it. And I'm like, you know, I talk about it with my friends. And I mean, I have guys that come through all the time. I mean, literally 2 weeks ago, we were standing in the office and there was like four of us. And, you know, you're reliving, you know, early days in Baghdad or, you know, and I talk about it in generality, but never like specifics. And I think that's okay. Like, you know, I like to make different types of content and I don't need to.
Yeah.
I don't need to use that to,
right,
to try to like drive traffic or CPMs. It's like, I make good coffee.
Yeah.
I make good coffee. I really respect a lot of the guys that have done that job for a long period of time. So I just never devalue it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure everybody's got a ton of respect for that. What are you kind of excited about coffee wise right now, as far as like, we made that crazy beer coffee earlier, but
that's a drastic departure from like, you know, sniper ops and in Afghanistan. I don't know. Yeah. It's like, I think the most exciting things happening in coffee right now is the fermentation process, like hands down. It's like what people are doing within fermentation and they're mixing things. Like some of the most exciting things that I think about all the time are, what can we blend with coffee to like bring out these different flavors? So we were talking about this Galaxy Hops, where, you know, they combined it with hops and it's got this really interesting beer taste with the coffee, which sounds disgusting, by the way. I'm with everybody on this. Like, it sounds gross. What the fuck are you talking about? It's delicious. And it's so wild. I talked about it on a couple shows. Like, my wife and I went to Seattle for our 11th anniversary and we went from coffee shop to coffee shop to coffee shop. And I love just drinking old school, what I would say is darker roasted, blended Brazilian South American espresso. Like, that's like my favorite espresso shot. But when it comes to pour over, we were talking about with Degenerates yesterday.
Yeah.
So when it comes to pour over, I want something that's way, way more fruit forward, has tea like body. So it's lighter, it's fruit forward. It's got some depth and it's got a really diverse tasting profile.
Yeah.
So I'm excited because I have this, like, I've been doing this where my second or third cup of coffee, I'll throw in some of the Firecracker Farms. I'll do a couple hits of that Firecracker Farms in there. So I want to mix
spicy coffee.
Yeah, I want to mix some like chilies or some jalapenos or something in that. I want to have this taste, but you can't get the heat because none of that oil will actually translate through the roasting process. So I'm trying to figure out how to get not necessarily the taste, but the heat, which I think would be the most interesting part of that.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like talking to Nick from Degenerates Drinking Coffee. We did a collab video with him on Instagram not too long ago. He was the one on the range making coffee with the new French press that came out. But we were talking about this yesterday. Like, it's so cool and refreshing to see kind of that the new era of veteran coffee guys, mm-hmm, that are coming about. That like, I think we've been kind of like waiting for that, that next generation of guys to like go down the rabbit hole on coffee, and kind of do it independently of BRC. And then, you know, we kind of come, and figure out a way to collaborate later on. Cause I think it's actually good that we, you know, Black Rifle doesn't have a monopoly on the coffee market. There's like so much room for us to collaborate and figure out other ways to help veteran coffee guys to come into the space.
It's, real coffee guys. Like that, like that's the other caveat to this is like, this is, I don't broker in toxic fuel, but it's like, we're real coffee guys. Like I've been roasting coffee for 20 years. Like, I'm a real, like when I say that, it's like, it's not some weird flex. It's like a lot of these guys saw the growth and the success of the company and they think they can slap a label on a bag and go out and sell it. And they can, but they're not real coffee guys. Like we have a lab, we develop roasts. We're like, we're in it all day, you know, 365 days a year. And I think it devalues coffee, like, which is what I would say is a cornerstone of my life. It's my profession. It's what I'm really passionate about. It's what my family's passionate about. It's like when you just slap a label on a bag, it's taking away from the depth, understanding the professionalism of the product. It's like you're devaluing it.
Yeah.
And you know, trust me. I mean, we've talked about this a lot where it's like, we see it sometimes, but I don't give a shit because it's like the thing that they don't have is they don't have a passion for the product, and it doesn't matter. Like, doesn't matter if I was like, you know, still teaching carbine on a range, or if I was, you know, rowing a boat in the Middle Fork, or if I was like an attorney somewhere, I would still have a coffee roaster in my garage doing 1 pound at a time. Going down the rabbit hole on, you know, fermentation processes right now, and I'd still be doing the same thing. Like I take my vacations around coffee a lot. Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
Like you can't fake it.
Yeah.
Like you got to love it, and you got to be in it for the long haul.
Yeah. That's very true. It's, you know, you put so much time and effort into something, you really take these steps, like break it down. Like, why is it worth it for us to like get so intrinsically involved into this, you know, substance that we like really enjoy? And I think it's one of those things, that kind of, it's kind of similar to life. Like you gotta be exposed to it in some way. And then you have a good interaction with it and you're like, why is this different? What about like this substance is different? I specifically think back to like there was a moment in Afghanistan when I remember one of my buddies in my platoon, he had Pete's coffee and he brought a glass French press and he was like, and I was always a coffee fan, just more of like drinking coffee with a breakfast burrito, you know, that was like, that became our ritual in the barracks, because where I was in Camp Pendleton, there was no, like, there was nothing. Like, we were in this area of Camp Pendleton that was, there was no food. Like, there was no restaurant. Like, it was just infantry. Like, that's the only thing. Like, 5th Marines, just infantry. Like,
sounds sublime.
It was awesome. And we were really close to the Cristianitos Gate, which was funneled right into San Clemente, which was, like, this really rad little beach town.
Yeah. Like, so, San Clemente's, like, it's iconic.
Yeah.
And I was like, especially like coffee, like you can get some incredible coffee. Yeah.
In San Clemente. I was 5 minutes from downtown San Clemente where I was stationed in Pendleton. And so that like, it was our thing, like go do PT in the morning. And then me and my buddy Jake would, you want some Joe? That was like the thing. Like, you want to get some Joe? Let's get some Joe. And so we'd go down, there was like one of those coffee trucks. And there's a coffee truck and then there was a burrito truck and we would get a cup of coffee and a burrito and that was our thing. I was like, I came, I was exposed to it initially through just, you know, I enjoyed the like caffeine side of things. And then I became like Afghanistan was when I became intrinsically in love with the process of it. And like my buddy that exposed me to the French press, and I brought one of those GSI Tupperware French press kits over. That was that was my thing. And there's like I have this photo of me that my buddy took, and I'm like that was my thing in the morning. And we ended up getting spread so thin in Afghanistan that like you were, you know, the most amount of sleep you were getting in the night was 4 hours, because you had to keep like everybody had to pull watch. Like there was no like, oh, snipers don't have to do watch, because they got like no, there's like 12 of us on this fucking outpost. Like you have to do fucking watch. There's just no fucking way around it, right? And so when you are just kind of existing with that lack of sleep for a long time, and then you're just getting into firefights a lot, like the process of making a French press and having that cup of coffee, like that was my 10 minutes of just, I was able to shut my brain off and just enjoy this process and kind of like find this vestige of peace within all of this chaos around me. And so I developed this like different type of relationship to coffee, to where it was like, this was peace. Like this brown water was like my peace. And it kind of just stayed that way. And then there was me and you and me and Ed, and I was like this other exposure. And what's fun about that, like the years of expansion that this has kind of happened over, you know, and we talk about it with the business, but like this is exactly what we hoped people would like come to find and appreciate about the brand is this, you know, we call it going down the rabbit hole on it, but like developing this relationship with coffee that like brings you so much more than energy, right? And it has become like one of these things now, like you know, you get as a veteran, like you kind of get a little exhausted, you get a little bit tired, like existing within the tactical community, or like everything's fucking special forces this, right, special forces that. It's just so fun to just nerd out about coffee now and like not kind of participate with that. Like it's still kind of like this closet passion that like is peace. Like it's like very much like it's peace. Like, oh, I just get to talk about coffee for a little bit. How fucking wonderful is that?
Yeah, it's like this shirt is a good example, right?
Yeah.
Like the shirt is the first...
Yeah,
espresso machine.
People would look at that and I would say so few people even know what that is, right?
You know, they look at this and it's funny because Tim Kennedy just completely fucked that story up on Rogan, where he's like, oh, you know, Evan spent money or whatever. And it's like, no, man, the supply, you know, the logistics officer of the base that I was working on came to me and was like, we want an espresso machine. And I was like, got it. This is the one you need to get. It's this La Marzocco Lineo 3, which is like the lawn tractor of espresso machines. It's just fucking bulletproof. You know, you can work on it, like bring it in out of Italy, but it's just going to work. And when you're in a fire base, or it wasn't really a fire base, it was pretty low key where we were. It was a nice base. And, you know, you could get an espresso, and my buddy V and another guy, Edwin, not this Edwin, but a different Edwin, we would like do lattes and all this other shit within this little kitchen area. And on this espresso machine that, yeah, was imported from Italy, and we put it in, it's probably still functioning at that base. Like it's been functioning there for, dude, 15, 20 years. So like, we definitely had a say as to what machine we wanted, but this was like the first machine. So for me, I wear the shirt all the time because
that's the machine that you
this got is the machine. Range. That's why I made this shirt. Yeah. Was straight up. And it was the first machine, espresso machine, that we bought with our money, not the government's money, with our money as a company.
Yeah.
So when we were, Logan and I, back in the day, we were sharing an office with a company called MyMedic. And there are some other guys with us, like Josh Tyler and some, like, from the, God, who else was there? But we were sharing that office with MyMedic. And the espresso machine was really just a backdrop to some of our content. It wasn't like plugged in. We didn't have water into it yet, but it was the first machine that we put in the coffee shop in Salt Lake. Then the next machine, and I kind of pushed those machines out because as we started building coffee shops in different areas, like I put that machine out. And then we brought in a different machine, which was the 80th anniversary for this really cool machine that we purchased at SEA. I've got a photo of it. I'll pull it up and I'll send it to everybody. But Simonelli actually had this really incredible black machine. Mm-hmm. And I bought it right off the floor when we were at the SEA. Oh man, that was 10 years ago.
And probably. SCA is like coffee expo, basically.
Yeah, it's
like,
yeah. It's like Shot Show Coffee Association. So it's like, yeah, and it's for hardcore coffee sycophants. Like, this is not for the faint of heart. When you go there, it's all coffee, and it's so interesting because it's like the cutting edge of what's happening within the specialty coffee industry. They have espresso competitions and AeroPress competitions. They're talking about roasting. They've got seminars. They've got all this stuff going. And then it's this like coffee community comes together. And for the longest time, it was just kind of us. You know, people would come to us like, man, we love what you guys are doing. You know, you're shaking it up, right? But now we're seeing, you know, a few more companies out there that are stepping in a little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit heavier. It kind of goes back to, like, we deal in mainly Arabica. We don't really typically do Robusta. So anytime you have a company that's really focused on caffeine versus taste, that's a Robusta, which is a smaller, more bitter bean. You can't really get some of the you can at times, depending on where the crops come from, but generally speaking, you're not going to get the same type of flavor out of a Robusta. You're just not. So we concentrate our efforts on higher quality Arabicas, and we don't really deal in Robusta. That's like a clear differentiating factor, because some of these companies are like, caffeine, caffeine, caffeine. I'm like, we have that product, which is CAF.
Yeah.
Like, and we all should know what that stands for, which is caffeinated as fuck. I have that product for people who want it, but we have a bunch of other things that are built for the customer. If you want a specialty coffee, single origin, you know, we have the exclusive coffee subscription. That's what we got. If you want high caffeine, you want a Robusta, or if you want something different, that's CAF, and then we've got everything in
between. Yeah. Was Robusta a human engineered, or was that? There's always just been Arabica and Robusta. You know, we've made names for it.
Yeah.
But basically
regions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but where did Robusta come from? Well, everything obviously came from India. The same thing, but when did that offshoot kind of develop? Do you know?
Vietnam, India. I'm not exactly sure. I mean, the origin and then like the spread from Ethiopia and then into the Middle East. You have the Mocha is an actual location, and I believe it's Yemen. So then it kind of goes Ethiopia, Yemen, then from Yemen through the Middle East, and then it's pulled into Europe. So a lot of the coffee shops in Europe, but as it's expanding, it's going around the world to be grown, so it can be imported back into different countries. But Southeast Asia, Asia just in general, that's kind of where the Robusta bean lives. And yes, it's in Brazil, and there's like lots of it down there too. But that's, I'd have to check the facts on who drinks the most. But if you go to Europe, most of their espresso is going to be Robusta. If you come here and you're going to do espresso in America, most of that's going to be Arabica. just generally speaking.
Yeah.
I hate Robusta with a passion. I love coffee. I love coffee in like all of its unique forms and flavors, but I have a level of disdain for Robusta that's for like laziness.
Yeah.
And trust me when I say this, I've done what I can do with that bean, which I feel is like somewhat acceptable, but I can't use it.
Right so you now. Don't even like Robusta being added to espresso?
Only it has to be less than 5%. Okay. So it'll get a crema, a little bit more of a pop. So you get a better crema off of Robusta bean. And it gives it a slight bitterness to it on a finish, but for whatever reason I can smell it, distinctly smell it, and I don't like the smell of roasted Robusta at all. So if I kind of hold my nose, which defeats the whole purpose of having great coffee, because it's like you want to breathe it in, right? You're it's this appreciation of the aroma, and if I don't like it, and it's just really difficult. Now, I've been able to change my palate to like it after a certain amount of time. So if I go to, like, I went to Europe 2006. I was in Italy, Croatia, kind of all over, and that's all there was. And I eventually was like, this is pretty good. But it takes several weeks of indoctrination, palate indoctrination, for me to appreciate it.
Yeah.
Can't just switch over to it.
Speaking of Europe, have you heard these claims that coffee was kind of responsible for the European Renaissance era?
Yeah, I've heard all of it.
Do you think there's some validity to that, or is that just like a nice, fun myth?
It's super interesting because the clerics, and as you start to look at people in power, they have either loved it or hated it. So it's been either discouraged or encouraged. There's like pontiffs or popes that were against it.
One of the popes called it like the devil's drink, right?
Yeah. And then the next one was like anointed. It's like angel's water or something, right?
Yeah.
So
now we've blessed it. Yeah. And then he tried it and it was like,
Wait, this is really good.
That's a good ECS. Like devil's, like it's half holy, half evil. And like the devil's drink, like we'll cut that back like right down the middle.
Red and something else, red and white or something. Yeah. I've definitely heard about it from the context of your caffeinated, your writing, your debating, your throwing around ideas. That's one of the things that coffee is amazing about, or one of the things that's so amazing about it is you get caffeinated and then you want to talk, right? You want to like talk, or you want to write, or you want to do something. And a lot of the coffee shops were balanced by the fact that people were hung over all the time or drinking so much. They're like, well, fuck, I need off
balance. Cause they can't drink normal water.
No,
because water's bad. So they drink a lot of beer.
Yeah.
I was so surprised when I first heard that. I was like, yeah, the children used to drink beer cause we can't drink water. Cause you know, 13, 14, 1500s Europe, just
beer,
good water didn't like really exist. So you had to have fermented water,
beer and wine.
And then you'd boil it. Make coffee, and so you were just going back and forth between beer and coffee.
And now we just kind of take for granted the fact that we have like pure water. And,
yeah,
you know, we can drink. Now we have pH balance directly related to the way that we infuse water into coffee at a very specific temperature. Whereas before, you're just boiling your water mainly probably to, I don't know if they knew how to purify it. It's like one of the reasons.
Yeah.
They're just trying to get over a hangover, or maybe plug in and get a little bit more energy. I mean, my history with coffee is like it directly plugs me into my childhood. Like it directly plugs me into my childhood. Like I remember that thermos rolling around
in the back floor. Of the truck. Yeah.
Yeah, the floor of the truck. You know, but every morning it was, whether it was work or recreation, that started with the smell of the coffee maker in the background, and then it was a thermos, and then it was
into the mountains for work or recreation.
Yeah.
My grandfather, my father, all these like very prominent male influences in my life, they constantly had a cup of coffee in their hand. And if you have a really positive connection with the people that introduced you to coffee, it kind of always connects you back to those people. And it connects me right back into the mountains and the rivers and the places where I kind of like grew up with those guys. And I think it's always been there, whether it's on a drift boat, you know, steelhead season, and it's like fall, it's cold, right? It's like, it's late summer, early fall, steelhead season on the river, and you get the clunk of the oars, like clunk, 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 clunk. You're kind of like back rowing into a spot where you can pull plugs and catch a steelhead with your buddies. Like, and it was also the first, I would say, sign of independence. It's like, I have a driver's license. So now I have a driver's license. Now I can go fishing by myself. I can get down, and I grew up on the river. So, like that was a big thing. Steelhead season, fly fishing for trout or fishing for bass or whatever it was. I grew up on two rivers. So independence was also getting up early to get out and put lines in the water.
Yeah.
And coffee's always been like, well, that's what we do, right? If we're going to get up early, we need to get a really big, you know, green Stanley thermos with that shiny lid. You screw off, you pouring out this brown water, and you're cold, and you're like huddled in underneath all your rain gear or whatever it might be. And you're like, just take that first sip, and the steam's rolling off that thing. You're like, you know what? It's going to be a good morning.
Yeah.
And that was the place, whether I was in Afghanistan or Iraq or Africa or wherever that was, like that was the place that coffee would move me back to, right there.
Yeah.
One sip, put me right there.
Yeah. Hearing you talk about the click clunk of the oars of the raft. It's funny. Cause it's also like exactly what we're talking about, but now it's like this, in addition to focus and productivity, like it kind of does this like memory unlock thing to where you have this substance. It's like, it's encompassing something that provides, again, like kind of a piece, but, but a complete, memory unlock of something that's like really beneficial to you in the present. So like you can touch on these moments of your past, and there's just not a lot of, you know, like humans love to be nostalgic, right? Like it taps into something within us, like liking something now, wherever we're at in our life that we liked in our childhood is like, it's good for us or something, or like it's strange how much we like being nostalgic about things. But to be able to take a substance and to be able to touch these moments from the past through this specific thing and this process, like you kind of feel like you're like putting yourself in a little time capsule. Like when you were describing that, I was like, oh, I know exactly that. Like I'm imagining myself sitting in that position with those oars in my hand instead of sitting here at this table. And it's really incredible to like have that specific thing that you can unlock these memories with.
I think about it very much like that, because I think of the thousands of cups of coffee I've had and the incredible places that I've had coffee in. And that could be, I was in Jerusalem multiple times, and they have some really good coffee shops in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv. And, you know, whether it's like Paris or Jerusalem or Tel Aviv or Rome or, you know, Split, Croatia, or where, like all these different locations, it's international. And it goes from the first time I tasted coffee in a small town in northern Idaho to drinking a great espresso on the streets in Jerusalem to the morning pour over that I had this morning with my kids. All of those events come together
every morning for me.
Right.
For this one experience that's like super ritualistic and very meaningful. But it's almost like they're pulling them all together for that one moment. So for me,
and they're all good.
It has to be good.
I don't have a single bad memory
that involves
coffee ever. Like, it's always a good thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I can remember, like, you know, trying some energy drinks. I'm like, well, this, like, not good, man. Like, yeah, this isn't too good. But, like, every single one, like, I can see being in El Salvador, driving that truck up the mountain to 10,000 feet where that Pacamara fucking bean is being grown. And, like, I look back, like, I can see all that in my head right now. Like, all of the stuff associated with this process and this substance is, like, it's all positive. It's
Pacamara. I haven't thought about that coffee for, like, as soon as you said Pacamara, I was like, oh God, that's right. We were way into Pacamara for like over a year, I would say. We were so into that coffee.
I still love it. I'm still all about it. Mm. I think it's so great. I'm so grateful for some of these things because, like, I remember being on that mountain and I remember Ed being like, this is a Pacamara cherry. Yeah. And I remember biting into that and I was like, whoa. I'm like, that's a peach, but little and so good. Fuck, it's so good. Like, what? Like, what? And then you're like, way more in love with this stuff, you know? And, like, the beauty of it's like, shit ain't something that's cooked up in a fucking lab somewhere. Mm. Like, Mother Earth supplies this under pristine, good conditions. You know what I mean? It's not gross. Like, and that's, I'm sure, also has something to do with why you kind of have the opinions you do about Robusta, is because, like, it doesn't need, like, as good of conditions in order to exist and develop and be able to be harvested. To whereas some of this stuff, it's like, it's pristine, unique environments that only produce like the specific taste, and like it's like the like more refined like earthly existence, and you can like touch all those places, but you don't know that unless you like fall in love with the process somewhere along the way.
I would highly recommend guys to like fall in love with the process and never waste an opportunity to create a great cup of coffee. All right, Logan's got to go to the airport, so thanks, buddy.
Thanks, y'all.
Appreciate it.